1, 2, 3, hit it, boy. Whoa.
So get together, have a few laughs.
Uh-oh. Shit, lady, do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza?
Lady, put the freaking gun down on the ground right now. Take your shot across the freaking street and say that Dooley's gonna get you.
Hello, and welcome to Where There's a Willis, There's a Way, a film podcast about the multitude of works by Bruce Willis. My name's Kendrick Martin.
And I'm Josh Carter. Today, we're going to be covering Ronin, directed by John Frankenheimer, written by J.D. Zick and David Mamet. David Mamet.
I like where you're going.
If this is your first time listening to this podcast, welcome. Also, what we do here normally is a little in-depth breakdown of a movie that's starring Bruce Willis, both from a film perspective as well as his individual contribution. We'll add the movie to our rankings, talk trivia, and do the Wheel of Willis. However, this week is not a normal week.
Josh, I hate to break it to you, but this movie didn't have Bruce Willis.
I know. I loaded it up and I was like, huh, it's weird that we're watching a movie from before the last movie that we just watched. And then I kept watching my screen, eyes peeled. I watched through all the credits, waiting for a post-credit Willis reveal.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Yeah, I thought maybe they were going to tell us that he was what was inside of the briefcase all along.
Oh, yes.
Not to get ahead of ourselves, but... he wasn't.
Yeah, spoilers. Yeah.
So what Josh is trying to say is that this is not a Bruce Willis film, but we still felt it necessary, nay, required of us to discuss because it's what we decided.
Yeah.
So that's how that worked out. I hope you liked this movie. You had not seen this movie, right?
I had not seen this movie yet before I watched it, and then I watched it, and then I had seen it.
Perfect. We're really just hitting all the branches of science here today. We're figuring out what we're doing. We're figuring out what we did. We're figuring out what we haven't done. I think that's
what certain birds sound like.
That sums up how science pretty much encompasses our lives.
Oh yeah.
If you want to find previous episodes of this podcast, I applaud you for that desire. You can head on over to williswaypod.com. williswaypod.com. The URL, williswaypod.com. There are other podcasts in the Last of the Action Heroes podcast network, and you can find those at lastoftheactionheroes.com. We would love a rating on iTunes. You can pop on over to itunes.com/rate and review the Willis Way Boys.
Is that like one word or is it under?
I assume you just type that into your browser.
Okay. Good science. Before we dive into this movie, we're going to give you guys an idea of if we think that this movie is worth watching. And normally we'll rate a movie a Bruce Willis out of a Bruce Willis. And today we're going to rate a movie a Bruce Willis out of a Bruce Willis because this rating system prevails and works in all cases.
The only downside is
that we have to explain it.
Which we never had to do before.
Yeah.
Never. We never had to explain our rating system.
Yeah.
I think it just goes to show the true power of the rating system that we have devised.
Oh, absolutely.
So, to recap, the Bruce Willis rating system, the more letters of Bruce Willis's name you rate something, the better it is. And if you rate something over a Bruce, we think it's worth watching regardless. Not to say that there aren't problems with it, but we think a movie that is not worth your time will rate less than a Bruce. So, Josh.
You punting over there? Because I'm punting a little bit.
You're punting?
I'm punting.
I catched and then passed it back to you. That's
Oh, no.
That's a football move.
Oh, no. That's a half court pass. That's what that is in football. And then they're rolling sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your hayseed is showing.
Yeah. I thought not at all about what I would rate this movie, but I will let the Bruce Willis guide me, and I'll give it a Bruce W. A Bruce Wee.
Wow. All right, that's been logged in the official record. I hope you don't want to change it. I am going to rate this movie a Bruce Will. W-I-L. Just one L.
Just one L? Okay. I was waiting to hear if you were going to rate it a Bruce Will or a Bruce Will.
Will. No, Bruce Will. I also had not seen this movie and knew nothing about it. If you listen to our last episode, we had Josh actually depict what he thought this movie was about.
True.
Which we'll read that here in a little bit.
True.
Needless to say, both Josh and I had no idea where we were getting into.
I originally had thought that I would just take like a shot for every correction, like prediction that I got. And then I was going, maybe that's not such a great idea.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe next time.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Before we jump into the movie, I just want to let everyone know that if they want to send us an email, holler at us at williswaypod@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter, williswaypod. Same thing on Instagram. And we have a Facebook page for the Last of the Action Heroes. It's just search Last of the Action Heroes. But before we jump into Ronin, we're going to take a quick break.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger.
Hi, I'm James St. John Smythe from the Drunk Bond Podcast. I review the James Bond movies. And even though I'm very misinformed and possibly have a drinking problem, don't be afraid. Just give us a listen. And if you don't listen, then I'm simply going to scream.
Secret Agent Man.
All right, we're now going to start talking about Ronin.
You ever kill anybody?
I hurt somebody's feelings once.
I never walk into a place I don't know how to walk out of.
Oh, I know you. I don't think so.
It's a small world. Not in my experience.
He was hired to lead a mission.
This is what we're after.
To recover a package.
We need to take it intact from several men who will be intent on preventing it.
Nice. My kind of job.
That some are willing to die for.
Relax, darling. Just a game. Could you take a picture of me and my wife? Get the background.
Guy goes for the case. Other guy's protecting the principal. Oh, they're good.
And everyone is willing to kill for.
I want $100,000. I want it up front. I want another $100,000 when you get the case.
United Artists presents Robert De Niro.
I won't hurt you.
Ronin.
You worried about saving your own skin?
Yeah, I am. Covers my body.
That audio was from the trailer of Ronin. I'm going to read the description from IMDb. A freelancing former U.S. intelligence agent tries to track down a mysterious package that's wanted by the Irish and the Russians. You can find this movie for rent on VOD. And I think we're going to go ahead and spoil the whole plot of this movie. But before we get into the movie, Josh, I'm going to read you what you thought your description of this movie was going to be.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah, go for it.
So this movie stars Sean Bean, Robert De Niro, Stellan Skarsgård, and a whole bunch of other well-known people. Your guess was that Stellan is possibly evil, maybe good, but dignified nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Bean, you initially think is a good guy, but ends up being a bad guy, and in the end, he dies.
Mm-hmm.
And the main character is named Tom Ronan, who gets whisked into the world of New York mob bosses. So of those, you got the first one right, and yep. The second one half right.
And then the third one completely right. That is exactly what happens. His name is Tom Ronan.
Yes, Tom Ronan.
Although so I will point out that I could be correct in that, because they don't actually say what his real name is. They only ever say Sam, and it's pretty clear.
Codename Sam.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that that's not his name in the movie. That's
it's also pretty codename. It's pretty clear, though, that his last name is not Ronan.
Maybe it is.
So this movie opens with a text crawl explaining what the word Ronin is. It's a Japanese term that basically means masterless samurai.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of the movie, they also take the time to re-explain what Ronin are by using little miniatures.
Which is good, because I wasn't reading the beginning part, because I'm like, whatever. Sitting down my water, text is on the screen. Bah. So it was perfect for me.
I almost always hate opening text crawl.
Yeah.
And so I would have been fine if they just cut that out. I wonder if they thought people were still confused just because they waited so long to explain what Ronin is.
Mm.
I will stand by the fact that I don't think this movie even needs to be named Ronin. I think the concept is based in this idea that these men are all former military or special forces from countries that no longer need them, and so they're kind of just wandering, fighting for themselves. But I don't think that's never that important to the plot.
Mm-mm.
And they make such a big deal about talking about how the samurai commits seppuku after like avenging their master. That is also doesn't happen or not part of the plot. And they even call out the fact that the samurai, after losing their master, kind of band together to avenge their master and then commit seppuku. I don't feel like any of these people are really out there to protect, you know, their former countries. Mm-hmm. So the title, I just was like, wow, this was such a waste. I don't know if they titled it after writing it or wrote it after titling it. But yeah, how do you feel about the title?
Yeah, I also thought that it was a little odd and confusing. It felt like one of those moments where, you know, like in those, there's an improv game where it's like first line, last line, and then you get the first line of dialogue and the last line of dialogue from the audience, and then you have to find some way to connect them. It felt kind of like that, where it's like, honor the scene suggestion, and they're like, well, I guess we'll work in this little, it's samurai characters that are miniatures that we'll talk about, and then the opening text crawl, and that'll be good. That'll be it. And then they got to check that box. So my idea is that they wrote everything, and then the studio executives were like, oh, I've been reading about Ronin. We should make it Ronin. And then they worked in that. That's my theory.
Maybe. I know that the movie has a lot of relationship to older spy films or kind of like action hero movies. So The French Connection and The Manchurian Candidate, which John Frankenheimer directed the 1962 version of The Manchurian Candidate. He directed Ronin. So there's definitely some connection there. And I was totally in love with all the spy stuff, all the action stuff. I just thought that I was a little worried once I realized what was going on, and I was like expecting a lot of kind of appropriative Japanese overtones, like these guys are all gonna end up being like samurai warriors or something. But they're told kind of halfway through what the Ronin were, what samurais are, and they're just like, I have no idea, let's move on. So
yeah,
So I suppose it could have been worse. It could have been worse.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that at one point there was like maybe a musical cue that was like, oh no, and then the rest of the movie is totally fine. So, yeah.
What did you think of the overall spy action plot?
I thought it was all right. For me, it's really hard not to compare this movie with like the first Mission Impossible movie, which I like a lot. For one, they both have Jean Reno in them, so I think that that's a part of the comparison. Yeah, but they're also like made a year apart or something like that. But kind of this end of the Cold War pre 9/11 has like a very distinct feel with the spy stuff, because it's maybe a little bit less, still somewhat, but a little bit less maybe American focused and like super nationalistic. And so it's interesting watching it under that context. I didn't care at all about any of the characters. And I think that that's a big problem with movies where they're like spies that are top secret and everything's a secret, because then you're like, what's your backstory? Oh, it's a secret. Or it only gets trotted out when you need to care about a character in other movies. And so I think that like a movie that's like the Bourne series, they did a pretty good job of kind of like telling you about the background of the character and giving you the reasons to care. But they did it in like kind of a contrived way as well with the memory loss thing. So I don't know how to make a movie that's like a spy thriller where you care, a political spy thriller nonetheless, where you like care about the characters on a personal level. I think that that's just a really, really challenging thing to nail in these types of movies. So like, as long as you're okay accepting that you're not going to get that, I think that it's a very watchable and enjoyable film.
Interesting, interesting. I thought that once Sean Bean kind of disappears, the rest of the team really gelled for me. And you're right, you don't ever really know why they are doing what they're doing. And I think that's a lot of, there's a lot of decisions made on purpose in that direction. So like, we already talked about the briefcase, but you know, nobody's ever told what's inside the briefcase. It's a complete MacGuffin. We never find out exactly where any of these guys from. They just kind of like vaguely reference where they're from. We don't know, do they have families, do they have relationships. There's like a brief relationship between Sam and Deidre, which felt very strange, and then is like never once mentioned again.
Yeah.
I didn't quite get what they were going for there, other than just like check the box of this movie has a sex scene, or a makeout scene. I don't even know if it's really ever indicated they had sex. Maybe they just make out in a car. But the team doing their like spy action stuff, I just enjoyed all that stuff. And I liked how, the person we're kind of seeing the least is the character played by Skip Seduth. I think is how you say his name. He plays Larry, and he's the driver. He's kind of always in the background a lot, and he's, you know, cooking food, and maybe he cracks wise here and there, but doesn't do a lot. And so he gets shot fairly early on. And I was like, oh, well, this guy's going to die. You know, he's like the red shirt of the team that causes everyone to be kind of saddened. But then they like rescue him and take him in and help him. And I was like, oh, wow, that was an interesting twist. The fact that they didn't just let like a character die. And then not that long later, he does just die off screen. And I was like, ah, there it is.
Yeah. I expected more of them to die, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially with that whole committing seppuku thing. I thought for sure there's going to be a scene where like they had to, you know, go back in. Like when Jean Reno comes in at the end to save Robert De Niro's character. But even though he's pretty wounded, I was like, oh, well, here he's going to die. And this
is that's what I thought too. Heartfelt
moment. Because I thought they had a really good relationship, the two of them.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of like great moments where they're kind of like opening up about their past, and they both feel, they both save each other's life a couple times, and then they both feel like they owe each other, and so they're working to try to help each other out, even beyond, you know, financial means and stuff. I thought their relationship was pretty well done.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, I thought that the spy's craft stuff was all worked pretty well for me. Like the scene where Robert De Niro and Natasha McElhoney, I think is her name, where they go and they walk around Nice and they're like pretending to do all this stuff. And he, you know, gets a guy to take pictures and all this and all that stuff.
That was
all really interesting. And the like setting up of a thing to fall over to see how they reacted to a surprising noise, that that all worked really well for me. One thing that did not work for me was at the beginning, and I believe this is called out in Roger Ebert's review. Okay. I'm quoting from Roger Ebert's review here. Quote, "Consider the elaborate opening setup in which Sam, the De Niro character, reconnoiters the bistro before going in. We assume he's going to attack those inside, but actually he's only attending a meeting of all the men that has been... that have been called by an IRA pay mistress named Deidre. Why do you go around to the back? She asks him. I never walk into a place I don't know how to walk out of, says De Niro, who spends the rest of the movie walking into places he doesn't know how to walk out of.
Yeah.
End quote. That quote made me laugh because that scene is so strangely set up.
Yeah.
And he like hides the gun at the door. And I'm just like, what is the point of all this? And I thought maybe later he was going to have to try to pull that same stunt where he'd hide a gun somewhere, but no, it's just awkward spycraft things that I thought didn't work for me. But otherwise, so another example of something that did work for me was he uses coffee to try to suss out the situational intelligence of his team members. So he sets up a cup and then knocks it off, and Stellan Skarsgård's character like catches it really fast, and he's supposed to, you know, be like, oh, I have fast reflexes, and then he does the same thing to Sean Bean, and Sean Bean just knocks it over, and Robert De Niro gets a drop on him. Yeah, I enjoyed all that stuff. I was thinking as I was watching this that pre smartphones spy movies really made a different kind of story, and I almost wish that we would see people make a spy film set like a James Bond or a Mission Impossible or something set in the 90s, because there's just something great about the fact that they have cell phones but they don't have cameras and GPS, and the crowds don't have no one is like stopping to take photos of them, and so they're able to kind of like maintain some anonymity even though they're
in these public places and stuff.
Yeah, doing all this stuff that today people would just be immediately filming them, and their faces would be everywhere.
Yeah.
I like that whole concept to me was really fascinating, and I just thought that a lot of modern spy movies, thinking specifically of James Bond and Mission Impossible, use technology a lot as just sort of a crutch for plot purposes, because you can write, you know, a computer to do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
But that 90s era setting where you pretty much were analog the whole time, I really liked. I think having cell phones though really helps people communicate, like helps skip long scenes where two people can't communicate with one another because they don't have a payphone.
Yes.
That's why I thought that like late 90s era spy thrillers had some really good stuff.
Yeah, I agree. I think that not to sound like a complete old man, but smartphones have ruined a lot of the ways that like modern movies kind of end up having to explain away like plot contrivances and stuff like that. Like in a horror movie where people are trapped in like a house or whatever, you're constantly like, well, why don't they just use their cell phone or whatnot? And so you have to like explain away all these different things, whereas in other times they didn't have that. So just set your movie in the 90s or whatever, and then it won't be a problem.
Yeah. I think we're just now approaching the kind of pop culture point where the nostalgia for the 90s is big enough that not only can you get a lot of good story writing elements, but you can also draw a lot of people in with a story set in the 90s. So I'm expecting we'll see a lot of stuff set in the 90s here before too long.
Yeah.
We're already seeing, I think there's like a American Horror Story anthology series or something set in the 90s. I thought I saw that recently on the news somewhere. Let's talk about the car chases. So this movie is known for its car chases. I thought this movie had some of the best car chase scenes of any movie I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Especially the last one. I didn't really like the first one in France at all.
I think they're all in France, aren't they? But
maybe.
Yeah, the last one, definitely the most intense. I think they all have... they all really up the level of tension because they're killing innocent people right and left. And that really stuck with me. And I think it makes sense from a storytelling perspective. Like, you can't just ignore the fact that, you know, there are people out there. But it really added like a visceral sense of this, what was going on. Because there's like people getting hit by cars and stray bullets. And yeah, it made this movie very intense.
Yeah, because like our characters that are the protagonists are not good people by any means.
Yeah, they're we're never supposed to think that they're like somehow saviors of humanity.
Yeah, which I think is another thing that movies have kind of strayed away from. They really want their characters to be the good guys a lot of the times. It's like, nah, just give us a movie with some morally ambiguous characters.
Yeah. Do you think if this movie were made today, they would try to make it into like a cinematic series?
Possibly. I mean, like, I could totally see myself watching another movie with Jean, whatever his name is, Jean Renault. Is that how you're pronouncing his name?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jean Renault and Robert De Niro working together in like 2002 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. Probably.
Probably. I think the movie really works well standalone. I don't think it needs a sequel. I think that there's, you know, a story that could be told sequel wise there, but yeah, I just wonder if maybe today they would have tried to, if part of the reason a lot of your protagonists are seen as such kind of paragons is so that you can have later stories with them versus people start to go, should we be rooting for this guy over and over again?
Yeah, you can just see the articles like, why rooting for John Ronan or Tom Ronan is a bad idea. So,
yeah. Another thing that really stuck out to me about this movie is not only do a lot of innocent people die, but it does not take, like, there's that scene where he's going to kill a kid. And I don't know why. It's never, other than the fact that apparently he's a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
I am just at a loss as to what the point of that was and who just thought it was a good idea to just have a scene where you roll up on a playground and pick a random kid to kill.
Yeah, that scene was a little bit intense. Throughout the entire movie, I was just like, I'm so glad I'm not watching this downstairs in the living room where like four different roommates could in theory walk by and be like, oh, is some kid about to die? Me being like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a little much. So, yeah, I don't know. Because it was like, I already believed that that guy was evil. Like, I didn't need that scene.
Yeah, he betrayed his rest of his Ronin bros, his Bronins.
His Bronins, and, if you will.
Yeah, and he could have just like threatened some stuff and then he still ended up killing that other guy.
Mm-hmm.
But then he actually does like try to shoot a kid and he misses. But yeah, I was just like, this is too much.
Yeah.
The way the movie was going, and I fully expected them to actually show a kid getting shot, and I was about to be like, oh, well, sorry, podcast listeners, you're going to get half a review from me.
Yeah. Yeah, that was odd.
Yep. Did the politics of the movie work for you? We're pretty far removed from the whole IRA being in the headlines.
I feel like I should read a world politics book before I watch any of these movies from this era in order to be able to like get what the fuck is going on.
Yeah. I guess that's my question is I assume you probably didn't fully grasp what was going on, and I didn't know if it mattered to you or if you felt confused at times.
Yeah, I was definitely confused, like for sure. Yeah.
Did that like detract from your enjoyment of the plot, you think?
I think so, because like this movie has, I'd say, a few different things going for it. It has like the plot, it has the personal stories of the characters, which I've already said are non-existent pretty much. And then it has like the action of the movie. And so I really enjoyed the action, was very confused in the plot a lot of the times. And part of that is purposeful, like the movie being obtuse about the what's in the briefcase and stuff like that. And other stuff is just like, oh, I don't know what this is. So yeah, I think it detracted, but not all that much, because there's already other stuff that was confusing in the movie on purpose. So I think that it's easier for me just to subconsciously be like, ah, this is all confusing, instead of like, well, you know, maybe if I learned a little bit more, it would be a little bit less confusing, but whatever.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. What about you?
I am familiar with that time of history. I still thought it was kind of needlessly confusing.
Okay, good.
I don't think it really necessarily added a whole lot to the plot. Like, I think as long as you understood kind of who the Deidre character was and who the Jonathan Pryce character were, and how they were kind of like fighting with the Russians to get this thing back and forth, I think that's really all you need. It's basically just a little bit of glue to connect all these big action set pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the ice skating. We haven't even talked about the ice.
Oh my god!
Another intense, like unnecessary death that was. I wasn't sure if they were going to go through with it or not. I think there's a quote from John Frankenheimer. I could be misquoting him. Someone involved in the making of this movie said they specifically wanted a shootout on an ice rink to happen, so they like specifically wrote that scene so that someone would get shot on an ice rink. Because they wanted that I don't know if that's had happened before this or not, but
yeah. Yeah, I definitely don't think that would, maybe it would read the same today, but even just a few years later, they would have had to totally change that, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was something else I was going to mention. Oh, so speaking of confusing plots, I don't quite understand why Sean Bean's character, they let him go. Was it something around like how he freaked out early? Because he's definitely like had the makeup cues of someone heavily on drugs at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he started freaking out at that first like ambush car setup scene. And then did I like just blink at the wrong time, or? Well, it seemed like an amicable, like letting go. At least I kept waiting for him to come back.
Yeah. Same
here. Here I am.
Yeah. Same. I was like, oh man, the bad guy's going to take off his mask and it's going to be Sean Bean underneath.
Exactly. But, exactly.
I mean, and even the trailer, it's like, if I were to cut a trailer to make you think that Sean Bean is in as much of this movie as possible, I would cut the trailer pretty much exactly how they cut it. Because it makes it seem like he's going to be in the movie for like a long time, and he's in it for like 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And then he's gone.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, that was wild. And I don't know why they fired him either, but it did seem like, well, it's just not going to work out. Let's part ways. And he's like, well, have a good rest of your time. And they're like, you too.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
Like, that was the entirety of their interaction.
Yeah, so essentially what happens is they have a meet scheduled and they show up, and then Sean Bean's character, looking extremely sweaty and pale, goes over there, and then they're kind of, then Robert De Niro realizes it's an ambush and they have a shootout and they escape and they get back to base, and then they're all kind of mad at one another, and then Robert De Niro threatens Sean Bean, and then it's pretty obvious to everybody that he's not cut out for the work, and then he just takes some money and leaves. And I thought it worked in the sense of it was surprising, and I think a lot of these movies can become so rote that they you just know every plot point before it happens. Mm-hmm. Like, you're like, oh, Sean Bean, he's going to betray them, or this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen. So I think it was good from a surprising aspect. I just felt like, because it was Sean Bean, well-known actor, even then, I think he, you know, people were familiar with him. He's billed fairly high.
He had been in GoldenEye at that point, so definitely well-known.
Yeah, GoldenEye was just a couple years before this.
Yeah.
So people knew what they were doing with him, but that's why I kept like waiting for the other bean to drop, as it were.
Sean's bean to pop back up again.
Yeah, okay. That's that's maybe for a different film.
Oh no. Yeah, I was definitely right there with you, like, just waiting for him. But yeah, this movie was definitely a lot less contrived than it could have been. Like, it could have been a lot worse, and I think that it's got a lot of elements in it where I'm like, oh, this is workable, this is fine. I'm not gonna like hail it as one of the greatest action movies ever made or anything like that, but the plot was what it needed to be, and it's elevated by, I think, the performances and the action for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I stand by the fact that this movie has some of the greatest car chases.
Yeah, the car chases
are of great. Any movie. I wanted to find, maybe if there's like a Blu-ray out there, it might have been on this, but I watched the online VOD version, so there might be a behind the scenes on kind of the filming of some of those car scenes. Mm-hmm. Because like I mentioned, a lot of innocent people die, not only like just bystanders, but other cars are getting smashed into. There's a scene where there's a truck that's like a semi carrying other cars, you know, and one car hits it, and then that car kind of like slowly rolls off the semi kind of into the traffic of everybody else that's going on, and all that stuff. And they go through like a produce stand.
Mm-hmm.
People are flying, you know, jumping out of the way and all this stuff, the tight, narrow European alleyways. Had to have taken so much work to choreograph and get perfectly everything timed just right. They have that, you know, they shoot rockets at cars. So there's cars exploding. There's all kinds of stuff taking place, windy Italian roads. And this movie, they did not edit in the actors driving. What they did is they used a special alternate drive car, so like the right-hand drive cars, you know, but they then mocked up a steering wheel on the other side. So basically, you can't see just off camera there's like a professional driver driving, but the actor is shown in the other side pretending to drive. And so they were riding in these cars as they're doing like these terrifying twists and turns and all these
wild
shots. Yeah.
That's very cool.
What was it like? Because you actors were right in the middle of those car chases. This is not a bunch of phony baloney stuff.
No, it was frightening sometimes. But they were Formula One pilots driving the car, so
But you had to be a rider. I wouldn't even want to be a passenger. Because weren't they going sometime at excessive speeds?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like Le Mans or something, you know?
Yeah, that's true. And in the middle of the mountain, it's quite, you know, the sequence, you haven't seen the movie yet, but the sequence up Nice in the mountains, fantastic. I like that.
I think the narrow streets and going through the tunnels of Paris would bother me even more than that. Mm. Yes. At any time, did you just hold on and were you so frightened that you just thought you couldn't stand it?
50% of the time you're like, oh my God, we're not going to pass that corner. And it's done. Yes.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I think it definitely shows. Like, the plot and some of the other action is a little, like, questionable, but the car stuff in this movie just, like, held me enwrapped the whole time.
Oh, yeah. And there's how many chases? 3 or 4?
Yeah, at least 4, I think.
So what's the second one the, like, the first briefcase stealing sort of thing?
Yeah, I would, yeah. Yeah. It's not really, it's like a loose car chase. You're just kind of like some quick clips as they're trying to get out of there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the other ones during the daytime, I think, are much more action-filled.
Yes. Yeah, those daytime car chase scenes, I loved. I was very, very enthralled those entire scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else you want to talk about this movie before we move on?
I'm trying to think if there was anything else. I know for sure that I just wanted to call out, because I'm not sure if we're going to do like a little separate section where we talk about the actors and stuff, but like, we've already covered him a little bit, but Sean Bean is just so good at playing just like absolutely Mad Men like characters.
Yeah.
He's phenomenal. And so I wrote that. I wrote down that I also loved Stellan Skarsgård in this movie. I thought he was so great. So great.
Always great. Yeah. Always love seeing him.
Yeah. And then one other thing that I wrote about that I had talked about briefly was that like ice skating rink thing. Mm-hmm. The entire movie, I was like so confused as to why they kept cutting back to the Russian character. And then I was confused because I thought that the ice skater must have been in on it too. And then when she wasn't in on it, I was like, huh. So you're just telling me that your like boyfriend / fiance / husband or whatever is just like always answering phones with like 60 guys around him and is like being stressed all the time and has so much money and won't tell you where he gets it. And this isn't like a red flag to you. I was just like, I don't know what this character is thinking, this ice skater character. But
you don't think she knew he was just part of like the Russian mob and was just kind of like left at that?
Maybe, but I don't know. I feel like that would be a pretty... All of his stuff would be pretty big red flags to me, but maybe she likes some.
You're definitely right. It should be. I guess I just thought of it of like, he's a big mobster who's very expensive and treats her very well. He obviously, the mobster guy seems to care for this woman. He, you know, we never see him mistreat anyone there and is paying a lot of attention to her practice and perform. So,
mm-hmm. I mean, we never see him mistreat anybody except for when he like doesn't give money for a case.
Yeah. He's obviously, you know, not the most up and up of gents.
No, I wouldn't say so.
For as important as this case is, they definitely spend a lot of time trying to not just pay the man who really just wants
I know.
He's like, I will simply take some cash. And they're like, all right.
It's a true American picture, though, where like instead of paying people for their product, they would much rather do everything they can to steal it from them.
So the real criminal is the capitalism along the way.
It's true. One other thing that I thought And I get that you have to do this with spy movies, but I love it in a spy movie whenever anybody puts on a uniform and then they get asked zero questions doing anything super suspicious. Like when he has the cop uniform on at the end and he's just able to use a get anywhere card and do anything card and go after that man card. It's like, what the fuck?
Though to be fair, Robert De Niro chasing him also had no problems getting anywhere, and he didn't have a uniform on. So.
It's like, whoa, these people are terrible at crowd control, or this is very convenient. And then my last thing that I wanted to write, or that I wanted to talk about, was that I hated, if there's anything more that I hate than like opening title cards, it's ending narration in movies that don't need it. Being like, well, I'm a spy, and that's what happens when you are a spy. You live your spy life.
There was an alternate ending to this movie that ended with the camera showing Deirdre outside the cafe, you know, at the end, kind of like contemplating going in, and then the IRA kind of show up and kidnap her.
Oh, interesting.
And presumably killing her. But in the DVD commentary, John Frankenheimer said that early preview audiences did not like it and they didn't want to see her die. So I pulled that out.
Yeah, I don't know how I would feel seeing her die either without knowing like what else they had considered, but
Again, I didn't really like buy the relationship between her and Sam, Robert De Niro's character. I thought that they either should have played into that more or
not done it at all.
And I guess even as it was, it would have been fine if it was just kind of like the two of them being like, "Hey, we're we're here. We might as well. We got a few hours to kill." But then at the end, we're supposed to kind of think that Robert De Niro is pining for her in that cafe and just waiting for her to come back. That I didn't buy that at all.
Yeah.
But small potatoes in the grand scheme of things.
Absolutely. The tiniest small of potatoes.
Tiniest of potatoes, yeah.
One other thing that I wanted to talk about with this was do my daily duty of every time we record where we talk about the budget and box office numbers. So
I usually wait to go to the bathroom for my daily duties, but
Oh, that's true. Yes, and good job, Kendrick. And
commit to the bit, Josh.
I hope that you have a good potty. Anyways.
All right.
Too much commitment? Pull it back?
Nope.
Commit further?
Yep.
Oh no.
Neither of us know how to get out of this. We've spiraled into a agreement loop.
May your porcelain time be pertinent. I don't know. Anyways, right. The budget for this movie, 55 big ones. Big ones being U.S. dollar million in 1998 money. And it earned 70 big ones plus 7 little ones, which is hundreds of thousands.
Okay. Wow. So to recap, 55 big ones got you 76 big ones?
No. I do see where the confusion's coming in. Oh my God. 55 big ones got you 70 big ones plus 7 little ones, which are hundreds of thousands. So it earned some money back. It earned 15.3 big ones back.
So this is worldwide or just America?
This is the numbers archived. Yeah. I'm not sure.
It's It's worldwide. It's worldwide.
Okay, good.
According to Wikipedia, it was 1998's 11th highest grossing R-rated film, which I saw that. I was like, 11th highest?
What the
hell?
That doesn't
seem very good. How many R-rated movies came out in a year? But it's, yeah, it's like its TV Guide, you know, award here is 11th highest, 1998.
What?
Did you know that? So this movie premiered at Venice, and I think it was quite popular overseas, but according to its box office, it didn't appear to make a lot of money overseas.
Interesting. Oh, there were actually... I'm just looking at the box office performance for R-rated movies in 1998, and there were some really good ones in 1998, so...
Rush Hour, was that rated R?
I don't see it on here, but like Blade was above it, Lethal Weapon 4, Good Will Hunting, There's Something About Mary, Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, geez.
So yeah. Like that's a tough year. That's a tough year. Also, Ronan beat out The Siege by like one big
Ooh.
One. So.
Oh. Yeah. One big one. Well, that's good that I made some money back. I know that the general feel for the movie was kind of like a medium acclaim. I think it got like a 7 on Rotten Tomatoes.
It got like a 7%?
No, a 7 out of 10.
Oh, 70%. I was like, a 7? That's brutal.
Yeah, I stand corrected. It was 6.24 out of 10 on Metacritic, or Rotten Tomatoes. Sorry. Mm. So, not great, not terrible, but I feel like post-release, it's definitely earned a lot more acclaim from, you know, what we've talked about so far.
Yeah.
The lasting elements.
Yeah, I think that maybe it was a thing with, like, market saturation at the point, because I mean, like, on that other list of other R-rated movies that did well, there were other like political thriller types of movies, like Mercury Rising was on there and The Siege and stuff like that. Like, I could imagine how watching The Siege and Mercury Rising and Ronin all in the same year, you're just like, enough already. But I do think that this movie is It's good. So, yeah.
Okay, before we keep going, let's take another quick break.
There are pretty faces that you find.
Hey, dear listener, thanks for listening. If you're looking for a way you can help support this podcast, well, first of all, we would love it if you would go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a star rating and review. That's definitely the easiest and cheapest for you way you can help us. If you're looking for another way to help out, you can head on over to anchor.fm/Willis-Way and hit the support button and you can send us a few bucks. This podcast is definitely just a labor of love from Josh and I, and we definitely don't expect any form of financial donation, but we'd love anything you can send us. Thanks again for listening. All right, Josh, this part of the podcast episode is our Star Trek connection. Now, before we get to the Star Trek connection, I forgot to mention this earlier, but did you know that there is an article on The Guardian that I read today that says NASA to slam spacecraft into asteroid in mission to avoid future Armageddon?
I did see that, and then I thought about sending it to you, and then I totally spaced it. So I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's a great idea.
I cannot believe that we are now having a real life Armageddon type interaction with an asteroid. And of course, all of Twitter is just talking about the fact that we know the asteroid is made of rock and we just need to drill into it.
Yep. Yep. Underneath that tweet, there was another tweet by somebody that said something like, that won't work because of the mass of the asteroid isn't going to be moved based on the mass and velocity of the rocket. So this is foolish. And then, like, in the comments, just people were clowning on that guy, being like, bro, you should call up NASA and let them know that their idea is bad. That's good science, my dude. Good science.
Yeah, way to go.
So,
way to go.
Yeah, maybe NASA should listen to that guy. He sounds like he knows what he's talking about.
Internet rando one, you know, NASA zero, I think is obviously where we're at here.
Oh, truly, truly.
So, yeah, all that to say, Star Trek Connection, this is the part of the podcast where we find a way to connect this movie to the greater Star Trek universe. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's a stretch. I expected this to be a little bit easier than it was. It was actually kind of hard.
Mm-hmm.
we found two people, one of which is this guy named Cody Dorkin, which is probably one of my favorite Star Trek Connection names. Unfortunately, all he does is uncredited ADR on things, so I can't really point out what he did in this movie, but I can tell you that he was both in Star Trek Insurrection and Ronin doing some ADR. In addition, Keith Carradine did some soundtrack work on Ronin, and he was an actor in an episode of Star Trek Enterprise. He played a Starfleet personnel guy in one of the episodes of Star Trek Enterprise. He is known mainly for his musical career. He's written some songs that have been won some Emmys and some Golden Globes and Academy Awards. So,
wow,
pretty great. Yeah,
that's excellent. Good for that person.
Yep.
Good for that person.
I agree. All right. Well, Josh, this has been wonderful. I just in this last hour plus of recording with you have had so many cobwebs. I've had to dust off my podcasting muscle brain.
I had to put mine back in the podcast box and then plug in my brain cells into the microphone and then get everything fired back up again.
Yep, definitely couldn't tell. So. Couldn't tell a bit through that whole bit you just told me. thank you, listeners, for listening to us today. We're glad you're here with us. We're glad we're back. We're glad you're back. Follow us on Twitter at WillisWayPod. You can email us willisWayPod@gmail.com. We would really like it if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. Just subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Get that little ding-a-ling ding on your phone whenever we drop a new episode.
True, true. Also, at the end of each episode, we try to throw out a little sweet treat, a recommendation for some other form of media. We want to lift up other people that are doing great works and give them a little shit out, if you will.
Sorry, what?
A little shout out. Okay. And yeah. So the one that I wanted to do this week is I wanted to plug the show Veterans of Culture Wars, which sounds like a lot, and it is not what you think it is. I was like, expecting to hear some, you know, propaganda, Big Bird is making us, our kids, communists sort of nonsense. And it is not that. Mm. It's about two people who used to go to one of the Mars Hill churches and have worked with Mark. And they talk about a lot of different stories and interview a lot of different people on their podcasts that are like related to religious types of things, particularly Christianity, but one of them isn't really religious anymore, and so he kind of talks a little bit about his beliefs and, you know, various spiritual types of things. And I've just really enjoyed listening to it. They always give me something to think about, even if I don't always agree with what they're talking about, but they're interesting. So check out Veterans of Culture War podcasts anywhere podcasts are found.
That is great. I'm going to be much more mundane and just name another Stellan Skarsgård piece of work, and that is Dune.
Ooh.
His recent big blockbuster sci-fi franchise that he's a part of. Dune is was in movie theaters. It's been on HBO Max if you have access to that. Definitely recommend both the book and the movie. I thought it was great. If it comes back to IMAX and you have the ability, I would definitely recommend seeing it in IMAX. I think definitely worth going to an IMAX for. But even beyond that, very good. Very good.
Yeah. And I would recommend watching it in theaters if you can, obviously. It's watching it on your TV screen at home is probably not going to be nearly the same experience, and it is an experience to behold for sure.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Where There's a Willis, There's a Way. You can follow me on Twitter at KMartinix. That's spelled KMartinix.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Joshing Carter. Next time, we're going to be covering Air Force One.
The first of the Air Force franchise.
Yes, right before they went downhill. I've never liked them after the 13th one. That was too much for me.
Too many Air Forces.
Air Force.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Oh, yeah!